So this morning I want to talk about Mara. Some of you know Mara better than you'd like to. Some of you don't even know who Mara is. So Mara is the equivalent of the devil in Buddhism. Like the Christian devil, Mara wants to own and control everything. And he does a pretty good job of it, or she does a pretty good job of it. Pretty skilled at owning and controlling everything. One of the differences between the Christian devil and Mara in Buddhism is that Mara speaks Buddha's spiritual language. The Christian devil doesn't seem to have learned to do that, or maybe I missed it. Maybe he or she has, but definitely Mara speaks Buddha's language. So sometimes it's difficult to distinguish between Mara and Buddha. Mara is sure of himself, sure of herself, never shows doubt, never reveals vulnerability or unseemly emotion. Seemly emotion, but no unseemly emotion. Mara is smoothly in charge. Mara knows what to do. And, of course, Mara appears to be fully realized. Right? Of course. But when Mara takes the form of a spiritual teacher, it's what we call narcissism. What we call narcissism. People who are narcissistic don't seek help very often. In fact, they almost never seek help because they don't perceive that they have any problems. And in Western psychology, people who are narcissistic use other people because they don't have a stable sense of self. They don't have a stable internal sense of who they are. So they're continually using others as a mirror, as an image, because they have nothing inside to feel good about themselves. So research that I've quoted before suggests that people who have narcissistic problems tend to be in the movies, right? In the movies, on stage, right? Because you get stuff back. You have this hole inside of you, and you get stuff back. They tend to be politicians. Right? Because you have a hole inside of you and you've got all these people rooting for you, voting for you. And what's the third thing they tend to be? What is it?
Ministers.
Yes. Ministers or spiritual teachers. It's true. It's true. Well, the research is clear. Research is clear. So we need to pay attention, don't we? We need to pay attention to this. And Mara can be quite empathic. Mara knows how to be empathic to satisfy her own needs if she can accurately perceive how someone else is feeling and then use it to get filled up. Use it to get filled up, right? Because of this hole. And Mara is generally radiant. You can think of a politician or two who's quite radiant, can't you? Whereas Buddha can be radiant, especially in the Mahayana scriptures, Buddha's radiant. But in Zen stories and in the Pali, sometimes Buddha's pretty unremarkable. Sometimes he's pretty humble. Sometimes he's like my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, who said, someone who thinks he is a good father is not a good father. That's all. Someone who thinks he is a good father is not a good father. And the story I tell lots of stories about Suzuki. So one of my stories is about his, I'll just tell the story quickly. I will tell an abbreviated version of it. So I went to, my teacher wanted to go to this woman's house who was named Mrs. Jones, whom we had not met before, in Hillsboro, which is where I'm from, but I was not from Hillsboro. That's where the one-tenth of 1% live. And I said, do you know how to get there? And he said, no, but let's look it up in the phone book. So he looked it up in the phone book, and he said, she's expecting me. So I took him to Hillsboro, the hills in Hillsboro, and we got to the address, Mrs. Jones' house. But it was a long stairs going up. I mean, you could barely see Mrs. Jones' house because it was from these estates, right? So he said, you stay in the car, I'll go. And then he was gone for quite a while, but I was quite a ways up there. And he said, he told me in the car on the way down that Mrs. Jones wanted to be a student and was really wanted to do Zazen with him. So he came back to the car, and he had a grin on his face. And he got in the car, and I said, how'd it go? And he said, wrong, Mrs. Jones. He said, and you know, he had his black traveling clothes on. You know the black traveling clothes Japanese wear? And she said, she thought I there to wash her windows. And he laughed. He said, too bad I didn't bring squeegee. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. Great laughter, no Mara. You go through Mara when you have great laughter. Mara is there, but you go right through. You pass right through. Humility. Humility. I mean, he was before I met my teacher, this was 1965. This is only 20 years after the war was ended, right? Only 20 years. In the part of California I grew up in, I only knew Japanese who were gardeners and cleaning women and men and window washers. That's all I knew. I had never met a Japanese person who wasn't. So she assumed he was there to wash her windows, right? And he thought it was hilarious. Hilarious. That was because he was settled inside. Zazen is about learning how to get settled inside. Settled. It takes a while, but you can all do it. We can all do it. So I'm going to read a few more stories. Let's see which. Oh, let's see. This Mara story. This is the first Mara story. This is when Buddha, the night before Buddha's enlightenment, right? That's when he first meets Mara. On the night of Buddha's enlightenment, he took a seat under the Bodhi tree in northern India. He resolved to sit there unshakably and not to rise from his seat until he had achieved complete freedom. Hi, come on in. That seat was saved for you. until he had achieved complete freedom. After a short time, Mara, the Indian god of delusion and evil, appeared, intent on stopping the Buddha from his goal. To do so, Mara sent his daughters, the most beautiful temptresses imaginable. But the Buddha was unmoved and simply said, "I see you, Mara." When desire failed to work, Mara got angry and sent in his vast armies. There were fierce demons with frightening faces and war cries, hurling cudgels, flaming arrows, and deadly spears. Again, the Buddha sat unmoved, saying simply, "I see you, Mara." Then the Buddha raised his hand to touch the armies of Mara with compassion, and all the spears and arrows fell as flower petals at his feet. Finally, Mara attacked the Buddha with doubt. "Who do you think you are? What right do you have to sit here to become enlightened?" At this, the Buddha placed a hand on the ground and said, "The earth is my witness." And with this gesture, the earth goddess arose and bore witness to the lifetime of patience, dedication, truthfulness, compassion, generosity, and wisdom. Wow. That had prepared Buddha for this night. Out of her hair came a flood of water, and the armies of Mara were washed away. So that's his first encounter. That's his first encounter. So Mara is the fear body, really, the fear body, the body of fear that we are encapsulated in so much of our lives, so much of the time. And whether we manifest it in a narcissistic way or some other kind of way, it's crippling. It's crippling. All we have to do is see the fear body, see it in a calm atmosphere, in a calm way. Just see it. And when we see it, we can actually see through it. We can see through it. We don't need to try to get rid of it, because if we try to get rid of it, it just gets spookier. But if we just are with it, if we just see through it, just see it. Don't try to see through it even. Just see it. Then some spaciousness. We feel some spaciousness and some kindness, in which even Mara isn't separate. Nothing is separate. It's all together. And the fear body doesn't plague us anymore. Until it comes back next time. But we've learned how to practice vidya, which is the difference from avidya. Avidya is ignorance. In Buddhist thought, it's ignoring our ability to see, just to see, just to pay bare awareness, as I always say, that gets us caught in ignorance. Then we ignore. Then we get the whole chain of suffering going through our ignorance. Avidya, but vidya, seeing, vision, same root. We can do it. We can do it. It takes practice. We're practicing. Some of us have been sitting here in meditation for, this is our second day. We practice day after day, week after week. We practice. We practice on our cushions. We practice in the world. If we don't practice on our cushions, it's pretty impossible to practice in the world, because we get so caught. So Jack Kornfield has a comment about this story. When he was at his monastery practicing, when he was a young man, in the same spirit, when I sat in the forest monastery and the states of anger and aversion and irritation and judgment arose, I learned to say with compassion, "Is that you again, Mara? Wherever we are, Mara will appear with his armies, and we will have to find a way to hold our ground and remain unmoved." That's our practice. People have been sitting here very, very sincerely for a day and a half, trying to remain unmoved. Sometimes it's impossible to remain unmoved. Then we can move. But we can see. We can see as we're moving. We can be present as we're moving. We can see what the agitation is without judging it. So here's another Mara story. Later in Buddha's life, Mara comes on a visit. Mara, there are a lot of Mara stories, but here's another one. It's about Buddha and when he has his attendant, Mara. I mean, excuse me. Well, Mara kind of is his attendant. His attendant, Ananda. He's got two attendants, Mara and Ananda, I guess. One day, Buddha was in his cave, and Ananda, who was the Buddha's assistant, was standing outside near the door. Suddenly, Ananda saw Mara coming. He was surprised. He didn't want that, and he wished Mara would get lost. But Mara walked straight to Ananda and asked him to announce his visit to the Buddha. Ananda said, "Why have you come here? Don't you remember that in old times you were defeated by the Buddha under the Bodhi tree? Aren't you ashamed to come here? Go away! The Buddha will not see you. You are evil. You are his enemy. But when Mara heard this, he began to laugh. Mara knows how to laugh, too. And laugh. "Did you say that your teacher told you he has enemies?" said Mara. That made Ananda very embarrassed. So Ananda was defeated and had to go in and announce the visit of Mara, hoping that the Buddha would say, "Go and tell him I'm not here. Tell him that I'm in a meeting." But the Buddha was very excited when he heard that Mara, such a very old friend, had come to visit him. Is that true? Is he really here? The Buddha said, and he went out in person to greet Mara. Ananda was very distressed. The Buddha went right up to Mara, bowed to him, and shook his hands in the warmest way. The Buddha said, "Hello, how are you? How have you been? Is everything all right?" Mara didn't say anything. So the Buddha brought him into the cave, and he prepared a seat for him. He prepared a most comfortable seat in the cave with the most comfortable zafu and zabatan. Then he brought out an array of teacups with his finest teacups, the ones he loved the most, and had Mara choose the finest teacup. Although Mara was beginning to be a little flummoxed by this point. And then he had Ananda come in, and they had many varieties of tea, and Mara was asked to choose the tea that he liked, and they sat and drank tea. That's the whole story. That's the whole story. So, that's a pretty good story, huh? Can you do it? Yeah, you can do it. You can do it. Little by little, you can do it. This practice is little by little. It's not big by big. If you have a big experience, that's cool, but that's not so much, not at all our way. It's little by little, little by little. So I've been talking about when we sit, we try to return to just this. But sometimes Mara comes in. And then we have to recognize Mara and accept Mara. We have an opportunity to. It's not a should. We have an opportunity to recognize and accept him. And then return after that. Because we can't really return if we don't recognize and accept him once he's here. So here's a third story about Mara and Milarepa. Milarepa lived 100 years before. He's considered the kind of the founder of Tibetan Buddhism in the way Dogen is considered the founder of Japanese Soto Zen. Although there's lots more magical stories about Milarepa. There aren't any magical stories about Dogen. Just one magical story about Dogen, but I won't tell it. So Milarepa is practicing in a cave. And, of course, Mara, as remember, takes a multiplicity of forms. So Milarepa returns to his cave to get firewood. He's gathered firewood. Eventually, he returned with firewood to his cave and found it invaded by five horrific demons with eyes as large as saucers. Shocked, Milarepa politely introduced himself and asked them to leave. At this, the demons became menacing, surrounding him while growling, grimacing, and laughing maliciously. Milarepa was alarmed and attempted the most powerful of exorcism recitations to no avail. The demons became even more threatening. Next, the yogin tried with great compassion to give them Buddhist teachings, but they still remained more vivid and horrible than before. Finally, Milarepa realized that his approach was mistaken and that he needed the most direct means possible. And now he briefly describes his direct means. And here's what he said. I see you. Just like in the early one. I see you. I see you. I see you. Then I'm so happy that you have all come here to visit me. I'm so happy that you've all come here to visit me. Then do not hasten to leave. We will talk and play together. I invite you to stay all night. I have a comfortable bed for each of you to sleep in. So when I read this, and I read this fairly recently, I read it in relation to reading about the three enlightened actions. Actually, there are four, but I'm only going to talk about three. Three enlightened actions are karmas. Karma is action. We think of karma in a different way, but karma means action also. Activity. So enlightened activities. The three enlightened activities. When I read the three enlightened activities, I thought, oh, those three enlightened activities, those are really layers of acceptance. Because acceptance is the most important part of this path. Not just with your head, but with your heart. Acceptance. Let me go through them again. I see you. I see you. Well, that's the first part of acceptance, is just to see it. Just to see it. And that's called, referred to in the text, in the Tibetan Buddhist text, as pacifying. So the pacifying is not some doing some mantra or saying something over and over again. It's just saying, I see you. I see you. Very simple. Very simple. We're open to the shadow, to our shadow side, to our fear. We reverse the habitual tendency to ignore it, to hide, to run away from, to shut down. Then the next one is enriching. Once we've opened, once we've seen it, we can enrich. I'm so happy that you've all come here to visit me. I'm so happy that you've all come here to visit me. Welcoming unacknowledged aspects of ourselves with confidence by creating an atmosphere of celebration. Celebration. Free from aggression. Affirming the power of our dark side, of our screwed up part of us. We all have a screwed up part of us. Affirming it rather than discounting it. And then the third one, which I'm saying is the third layer of acceptance, is magnetizing. Do not hasten to leave. We will talk and play together. We're sure to have a good time. I invite you to stay all night, or maybe move in. I have a comfortable bed for each of you to sleep in. So here we're drawing the negativity toward us with an actual invitation from our heart, not just our head. And the shadow is charmed into a relationship, and its power is harnessed. Da-dum. Da-dum. So that's the story. That's the story. And in fact, the five demons then just joined with Milarepa and became his buddies. Although they still cause mischief sometimes, he had to continue his seeing, his recognizing and seeing, or they would do something. But as long as he saw them, let them be as they were, welcomed them, and then even magnify them, even use their energy, their psychic energy. That anger has a lot of psychic energy, doesn't it? That fear has a... Boy, if you can harness that energy, what can you do? What can you do? So, as I was preparing this talk and reading about the karmas, I thought about my own life. And I thought about two stories I tell that I've told here. One I've told probably 9 times. One, I think I've only told once, but I read it in this book that Wanda's doing. I thought, oh, I told that story of my talk. So one happened 15 years ago. So 15 years ago, I went to India because my son was marrying a woman of Indian origin. And I had to go to Linda, and I had to go to India to meet all the extended family, because that's just part of you don't do that. I mean, you just do that. And it was cool. It was cool. And of course, I'd always wanted to go to India because I've been drawn to its spirituality since I first read the Vedas, but even before Zen, the Vedas and the Upanishads and Ramakrishna and all that stuff. So I went to India. We went to India. And then after we left the family, we went traveling in India, and we landed, I don't know if any of you have been to India, but we landed in Mumbai, and then we took off from Mumbai. So we were in a very impoverished part of India. Most of India is very impoverished. Most of India is very congested. Most of India is very polluted. We didn't get to the Himalayas. Finally, we got to southern India. But most of the time we were in India, it was hard for us. It was hard for me because of the level of chaos, the beggars on the streets, the beggars by our cars, the open sores of the people who were begging, the deformed children. It was hard. It was hard. Very hard. It was not what I expected. But, you know, life isn't what we expect, right? And I recognized it. First part of practice. So I sat down in my zazen. I recognized it. I recognized my confusion. But I didn't move into acceptance. Instead, I moved into suppression. Sometimes we need to protect ourselves. We need to protect ourselves. And we move into suppression. And, you know, I may do it again. I may do it later on today. We just do that. It's part of our ego operating system to protect us. I went into suppression, meaning that I didn't want to hang out out in the street at all around Mumbai. I wanted to stay in. I didn't usually like air-conditioned room, but I was loving an air-conditioned room. I didn't usually like TV, but I was loving TV. And, well, Linda, my wife, was feeling the same way. But I won't. This is about me. So it was very hard, the recognition, the suppression. Recognition itself is great when we just see, but sometimes it's too much for us. And then how do we move to acceptance? How do we move? It's the key, although it has to happen organically. We don't know how it happens. It just happens by continuing your practice, wholeheartedly. So then I wanted to go to southern India and visit the ashram of Amachi, who is on my altar. Picture is on my altar upstairs, Amachi, because I had visited her, had gone to retreats with her here in the United States probably three times or something, Chicago and other places. And Amachi is the hugging mother. So many of you have heard about Amachi. She's kind of famous. She just hugs people. That's her whole darshan. That's her whole practice. That's her whole thing. Instead of Orioke, she hugs. Instead of Kinhin, she hugs. Instead of sitting meditation, she hugs. Although, it's still a very meditative atmosphere. Very meditative atmosphere, so I don't want to... yes, meditative atmosphere. Everybody's just sitting quietly. Listening to themselves and listening to the chanting and being there with her. So I went down to see Linda, and I got Linda to go with me. And we went down to see her. And at the ashram, and there she was already starting. She starts her hugging around, I don't know. She seems to start it in the afternoon and then goes to, you know, 2 a.m. or something. She'll do it for 10 people or 1,000 people or 1,500 people. I mean, she really does. She just has the capacity to do it. But she was hugging a different group of people in India because she hugs everyone. So those people that I'd seen on the street in Mumbai, she was hugging them. They were not the same people, but they had sores. The children were crying. There was people seemed really needy, hungry, but really, you know, hunger for food is one thing, but the hunger for love, the hunger for acceptance is so strong. that their hunger for food even seemed to be secondary, for their hunger just to be accepted, just to be paid attention to as if they were real human beings. The confusing part for me about being in India was that all of my new relatives said, "Don't give the beggars any money. Don't look at the beggars." I was really confused about that. But they said, "If you do, you'll get a whole horde of people following you for it. And you don't know, these beggars maybe work for some Mara guy." In fact, they likely do. So very confusing, right? But there, Amma is, and she's hugging everybody. And, you know, she's hugging the people with sores, she's hugging the people with hunchbacks, she's hugging the people who seem to have tics. Maybe they have a little Parkinson's or something. She's just hugging them. And she's doing it with openness, with kindness. she's not discriminating. And of course, I get to get hugged too. Why not? The more the better. And so I begin to experience some acceptance of them. That's the first stage, pacifying. I'm calmed down with them. I'm pacific. I'm open to them. The Pacific Ocean is open to everything. Even the crippled crab has plenty of ocean to be in. Plenty of ocean to be in. And this goes on, you know, for a long time. So it's like a sesshin if you just do it. Because she starts hugging at 3 and then or 4, and now it's 11:30 p.m. or 12:30 p.m. Really, quite a trip. Beautiful. So I begin to feel enriched. I begin to feel really connected to these people and moved by their openness and their pain. And so it becomes a wonderful experience. And I do actually leave magnetized, the third level of acceptance. I leave magnetized, and I come back home magnetized. And I come home, and it's just when my staff and my other agency, I have a job, I direct a nonprofit agency that has programs for people with mental illness. I guess this is my agency too. Whatever. My agency is my life. So they were just beginning to talk about homeless people. So I was so magnetized that I wanted to go out and spend time with homeless people. My first week back, I said to Patrick, "You go out to the homeless camps, don't you?" This is one of my staff. He said, "Yeah, I'm an insomniac." So I have to do something at night. So I go out to see my friends in the homeless camp. I said, "Will you take me with you?" So I began going out to the homeless camps because I was so magnetized. And then that magnetization has stayed with me ever since. And so in my agency, we've created lots of ways of helping homeless people, but starting by just befriending them, by just seeing them, and having our lives enriched by being with them. And then developing support for it, figuring out how to do it, even though you don't know how. If you're magnetized, you can help someone, even if you don't know how, you know. That's the big acceptance, isn't it? Big acceptance. So, the other story is a story that I've told lots of times, but in that story, too, I see that the three levels of acceptance, the three karmas, the three actions. The first one being pacify, just settle down and be with it, Tim. Those sores could be your own sores, and in fact, they are your own sores. Why get freaked out by sores? Just pacify. And then notice how you can be enriched by that, And then even relish it enough to let it magnetize you, and it will. So the other one is my brother's suicide. So that's The first story is 15 years ago. The second story is 30 years ago. They both involve this Zendo in a big way, because both 15 years ago and 30 years ago, I was sitting here every morning. So this is all has to do with Zazen. I mean, not entirely, but partly, because this is our Zazen practice. Now, we would like to have Zazen practice where we just return to our breathing, return to our body, but often we get caught by Mara. Mara comes up. Then we have to recognize the form of Mara. And we have an opportunity to open up and accept Mara. Pacify. Enrich. And magnetize. So my brother's suicide. And he committed suicide in a hospital for mentally ill people in California, and he hung himself from a sheet. And he was 10 years younger than me, and I had only one brother. And so I would come here and sit every morning after his suicide, except the times that I was, the time I was in California at his funeral. And I would sit here, and I would recognize my pain. I would recognize my pain. I would recognize my guilt. And then what would happen? I would criticize immediately. I would recognize, criticize. Criticism, self-criticism or criticism of others doesn't go with acceptance. You would have to pass through criticism to find acceptance. But I would criticize. And I won't get into all the trips I did on myself. I could go into them. I have gone into them many times before. I guess I won't go into them. But, you know, how I was to blame, how I was the only one that was there for him, supposedly, how I was a mental health professional, and I can't take care of my own brother, you know. Tripping out, right? Self-criticism. Any of you ever done that on your cushions? Any of you ever done that on your cushions? Maybe this much? Maybe this much? Maybe this much? No, we do it. It's a human situation. It's a human condition, right? But I just kept sitting. And then a pacification, a calming began to open. I began to open. Just to open. No big deal. Just open to the pain. Without the criticism. Just open to the feeling of loss, to the feeling of heartache, to the feeling of emptiness, but not in the Buddhist sense. You know, that emptiness where we just lack something fundamental that makes us want to be alive. Just opening to that. And little by little, I was able to do that. As you are, as we all are. We all are. That's our practice. And then, gradually, I moved on to getting enriched by it. I moved on to enrichment. I began to grieve. I wasn't able to grieve because of the inner critic for some time. Sometimes you can't grieve because your inner critic is so strong or you're so defensive. And it takes a while. It takes a while. But through the kindness of my Zafu and my friends, I was able to be enriched and grieve and hang out with my mother and my sister. And we grieved together. And it was quite wonderful. It was quite wonderful. And then much later, I became magnetized. And I say much later because, you know, the way it goes is I was enriched for a while, and then I'd come back to being self-critical. And then I'd come back not even wanting to recognize, not even wanting to sit, not even wanting to come. Now, I'd already become ordained as a priest, so Katagiri expected in those days me to be here every morning. So that was a little bit of an issue. He expected me. I want to stay home in bed. But I did it because it was the teacher's expectation. I did it. And I only live a few blocks, so I didn't have any excuse. I did it. And then gradually, the criticism didn't come back and come back and come back. And I began to get magnetized. But this took a few years. So if you're going to do Zen practice, this is going to take you your whole life, you guys. You should go somewhere else and do some other kind of practice if you think it won't take your whole life. It does. But each step is wonderful. Just one seeing is wonderful. Very encouraging. So, it doesn't matter. That's what your life is for, to open up and be there for yourself and others, isn't it? Why shouldn't it take your whole life? So, a few years later, well, I talk about mental illness. And that's one of my things I do. I talk, go on, give talks. And I always talked about my sister who has schizophrenia. But I never said a word for 5 years about my brother. Because, why? Why do you think? Too much pain. Too much self-criticism. Even though I'd been sitting and I was enriched, when I got in front of others, there was no enrichment left. Enrichment was gone. Oops. Bad. Bad. Not okay. Shame, shame. But then finally, I got magnetized. Really big time magnetized. And I began talking about it. Talking about his suicide, talking about how we needed to do something differently here for people who are depressed and mask their symptoms with drugs and alcohol instead of just kick them out of treatment program after treatment program, as they kicked my brother out of until he killed himself. How we can work with alternatives. As long as someone wants to move towards sobriety, we need to be with them the way Amici is with everybody, the way Katagiri, Suzuki were with everybody. We can do that. This is the lineage. This is our transmission. But it's a big lineage. It's the lineage of all the plants and animals feeling in their hearts each other's suffering and supporting them joyously. Joyously. So then I began actually developing services for people like my brother. Because lots of people in Minnesota, I found out, had committed suicide who were kicked out of treatment programs. And their underlying depression wasn't really dealt with in a compassionate, effective way. So those are two stories. Those are two stories. But you have your stories, too. We all have our stories. And when we're sitting together, I prefer that you not think about your stories. But if you have to think about them, do it with kindness, okay? Do it with kindness. Do it. Just see them as they are. Just see them. And then open yourself to them. And feel their energy. You get magnetic energy. You get magnetized by any suffering you have, by any dilemma you have, if you really go into it fully and accept it fully. So, by becoming, and Wanda was talking yesterday about intimacy, and today Wanda is going to be answering questions about intimacy, and don't know, at 4 p.m., and she's really good, and she can be really helpful to you. So please come at 4 p.m. Anyway, yesterday Wanda was talking about intimacy, and this is about becoming intimate with part of ourselves we don't want to become intimate with. But we become Buddha. Mara becomes Buddha. And what's Buddha? B-U-D, what does it mean? You guys know what it means, etymologically, right? To be awake. We wake. B-U-D, B-O-D-H-I, Bodhi, awake. We're awake. We awaken to the pain, the devil inside us, the confusion, we awaken to it. We awaken to it, moment after moment. It's our practice. It's our lifetime practice. We never finish it. If we finish it, we close down. It's a heart practice. And it gives us a lot of energy to help. A lot of energy to help ourselves and others. So that's what I want to say today. And let's see, normally I don't take questions during retreat, But I will take a question or two if anyone has a question or... Yes, I will. Anybody have a question or a comment?
I have a question.
Sure.
What is the meaning of the term bodhicitta?
Oh, geez. Well, bodhi means awake, citta means mind. So bodhicitta means awake mind. And there's something called relative bodhicitta, I'm going to try to keep this short, and absolute bodhicitta. That is, when we have an aspiration to live wakefully, that's within our mind. Our aspiration is bodhi, that's relative bodhicitta. And as long as we keep that aspiration alive, we're manifesting absolute bodhicitta. With that aspiration, we're manifesting the Pacific, our natural Pacific tendency to see and be present. Our aspiration turns relative bodhicitta when we think, oh, I'm just a little peon and maybe I'll get enlightened someday. But by being totally a peon, totally a window washer, in the best way we can, that relative bodhicitta is absolute. It's big mind. So a small mind, small citta, small little monkey mind is the mind of the universe, which is no mind at all. It's just life. Okay? She said okay. What?
The macrocosm and
the micro. That's right. That's right. Okay. Anything else?
I have a comment.
Sure.
And one of the verses that you tell the story of Buddha and Mara, and you talk about they got to be so friendly, such good friends, that Mara said, started complaining and whining, and said, Mara being people all the time. And Buddha said, you think it's easy to be a Buddha?
That's right. That's a great story. I did. There's so many Mara stories. I didn't talk about that one today. Did you hear that one, you guys? Say it loud.
It's hard being evil all the time. And Buddha said, do you think it's easy being a Buddha?
Exactly. So who is Mara and who is Buddha? Who is Mara and who is Buddha? We're always shifting roles, aren't we? Always shifting roles. Yes.
So are we inviting Mara in order to transcend him, her, or are we inviting Mara in order to know those aspects?
Well, if we think about transformation, we're lost. I mentioned transformation, but I should never mention it, because then you want to get transformed. So, you know, and then you're trying so hard to get transformed that you're not opening up to Mara. So, what was the other one you said?
That's a good answer.
Oh, okay. All right, okay. All right, so some of us are going back to sitting. Some of us are going back to enjoying the beautiful day. But both are wonderful activities. So, thank you.